This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's been record hot in Texas again, well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38°C, a month early at least. The Texas utility ERCOT set a new May record of 78,000 megawatts of power consumed, with AC working overtime. The heat went right up into Canada, with Winnipeg beating any May temperature in 137 years. According to the meteorologist Bryce Anderson, the Arctic had its second warmest January to April period on record, with the temperature 3.6 degrees C or 6.6 Fahrenheit higher than the 20th century average. Across much of the Arctic Ocean, Asia, Alaska, northern Canada, and northern Europe, temperatures were at least 2.5 degrees C, 4.5 Fahrenheit higher than the 1991 to 2020 average. With early summer heat in India and Pakistan, temperatures rose above 40 degrees C, 104 Fahrenheit, and in some locations got as high as 49 degrees C, 120 Fahrenheit. Thailand reached a record-breaking 42.3, 108 Fahrenheit in April. So far, we are experiencing the second hottest spring ever, just behind 2024. Are we stuck in climate acceleration? What is behind the strange burst of heat around the world and the crazy weather? You're about to hear best answers from a half dozen experts, including Michael Mann, James Hansen, Gavin Schmidt, David Victor, Leon Simons, George Solodiotis, and Yang Shu. Before we dive into what's behind the latest burst of worldwide heat, you should hear this short speech by Michael Mann. He delivers the keynote talk for the graduation at the University of Pennsylvania. It was streamed live on May 16, 2025.
Now, I've been a faculty member here at Penn for just under 3 years now. I was formerly a faculty member at Penn State for 17 years. Then I decided to cross the state off of my business card and come here to Penn. It was a natural home. My grandfather, father, and uncle all went to Penn, and my daughter just completed her first year here at Penn. Yes, we celebrated with a nice dinner the other night. So even here in Philly, I often encounter Penn State football fans. There might even be a few here in the audience. And they'll be familiar with the chant, "We are Penn State." I knew we'd find at least one of them in the audience here. We are Penn State, heard at the games. Yet too few know the origin of the refrain. Are there any historians in the crowd? Any historians? Well, let me provide a little history. The slogan dates back to 1946, when the Nittany Lions made history for refusing to play against the then-segregated University of Miami. When told they must leave their black players at home, the Penn State team instead voted to cancel the game. The following season, they were invited to the Cotton Bowl, and they were asked again to leave the team's two black players, Wally Triplett and Denny Hoggard, at home. They refused. Captain Steve Sui reportedly responded defiantly, "We are Penn State," asserting the oneness of the team. The full team ended up going to the Cotton Bowl on January 1st, 1948, in a matchup against Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, with Dallas still operating under Jim Crow laws at the time. It was a game that would become symbolic of desegregation. Triplett and Hoggard became the first African Americans ever to play in the Cotton Bowl. Well, we are Penn. And that stands for something we can be proud of, too. Our founder, Benjamin Franklin, would later in life go on to become the president of the Pennsylvania Society for the Abolition of Slavery. He petitioned Congress for abolition and wrote essays supporting the cause. But Franklin was many things. He was a statesman, a diplomat, a public intellectual, an inventor, a scientist, and I'm not sure many of you are aware of this, but indeed, like me, a climate scientist. Despite the famous story that we all learned growing up about Franklin and his kite, he did not actually invent electricity. That goes back to at least the 5th century BCE. but he was the first to chart the Gulf Stream. And he was an environmental activist. He designed cleaner burning stoves and brought a lawsuit against a tannery in Philadelphia that was dumping hazardous chemicals into the Delaware River. He was, of course, also a revolutionary who helped lead a rebellion against a ruthless autocrat, an actual king rather than a self-declared one. Franklin once said that to safeguard democracy, the people must have a keen sense of independence, self-respect, and their oneness. And he famously warned that we would maintain our republic only for as long as we can keep it. He was speaking to us here today. It is also a time of great opportunity for you, as my good friend Bill Nye is fond of saying, can change the world. I sometimes scold Bill, ever so gently, that it's important to finish the thought, for the better. There's some people who are changing the world, not necessarily for the better, but we can all change the world for the better. You graduating here have an opportunity to change the world for the better. What delights me most about being here at Penn is having the opportunity to teach, advise, and befriend so many future change makers. You give me optimism. You draw upon the important work you've done at Penn as you set out into the world to improve people's lives and make a better planet. Each of these Penn graduates in their own way are helping to make the world a better place. I know how difficult it must be for many of you right now as you prepare to leave the sheltering home of this university and go forth into an uncertain and at times exceptionally scary world. I know because I've heard from my own students, you're feeling the weight of the uncertainty surrounding the future of our nation and our world. You're worried about whether there will even be an opportunity to carry on your research and engage in unfettered scholarship, given the stiff, anti-intellectual, authoritarian headwinds of today's brewing storm. Yes, it's a time of great anxiety. And history will look back at this moment. There's no question about that. But what it will find depends on you, depends on all of you. It could look back and see a generation that threw up its collective hands in defeat, convinced it had no agency in determining its future, as our world transformed into maelstrom of toxic ideology, alternative facts, hate, bigotry, bitterness, despair, and hopelessness. Or it could look back in awe at a generation that rose to the challenge and fought back for truth, freedom, democracy, respect for science, factual discourse, and good faith. And yes, I believe it will be this latter scenario because of you. Now, before I complete my remarks, let me regale you with a story about my own college experience decades ago. In 1984, after graduating from high school in Amherst, Massachusetts, I headed off to Berkeley to demonstrate against the policies of Ronald Reagan, you ask? Or to participate in sit-ins protesting the apartheid policies of South Africa? And I did. I did do that. But that's not why I headed off to Berkeley. I'm sad to tell you that there was no larger purpose of that sort. I didn't go to protest or demonstrate. I went there to study applied math and physics among some of the world's leading experts. But ironically, it was that path that turned out to be the one that would lead me toward confrontation and battle. I would go on to study theoretical physics in graduate school and move into the then burgeoning field of climate research. My path of discovery would ultimately lead me and my colleagues to publish the now iconic hockey stick curve. In the late 1990s, the curve tells an unmistakable story, namely that the current warming spike is unprecedented as far back as we can go. Our continued burning of fossil fuels is the culprit. And fossil fuel interests and the various front groups, politicians, paid hands that do their bidding, target it and me for attack. Despite the numerous independent confirmations of our findings by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, and dozens of other assessments, the effort to discredit this research and to discredit me personally continued on. I was initially reluctant to remain at the center of the fractious societal debate over human-caused climate change. But I've ultimately come to embrace that opportunity. I'm convinced there's no more noble pursuit than to seek to ensure that policy is informed by an objective assessment of scientific evidence. I consider myself privileged to be in a position to inform the conversation about what is arguably one of the greatest challenges and threats that we face today. And so here we are at a crossroads. Never before have we witnessed science under the kind of assault it is subject to today in this country. Science is, to gratuitously quote the title of my forthcoming book with public health scientist Peter Hotez, under siege. And as Peter and I argue in the book, we face an even bigger threat today, which is the weaponization of misinformation and disinformation, for it undermines our ability to tackle any of the great challenges that we face today, be it the climate crisis or the threat of increasingly deadly pandemics. In closing, let me read an excerpt from the end of the book. It draws upon one of my favorite literary references. There's a theme here today. J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, which I consider to be an allegory for our time. So the diminutive hobbit Frodo was saddled with the crucial task of destroying the Ring of Power, and with it the Dark Lord Sauron, whose life force is inextricably tied to it. He's accompanied in this venture by his fellow hobbit and friend Sam. Frodo grows to doubt his resolve. His task begins to feel hopeless. The film adaptation of The Two Towers contains this exchange between the two. Frodo: "I can't do this, Sam. What are we holding on to, Sam?" Sam: "That there's some good in this world, Mr. Frodo, and it's worth fighting for." There is something ageless and archetypal about these literary references. There's no question about it. They're fictional, but they speak to deep truths and universal themes of good versus evil, heroism, and the time-honored virtue of fighting the good fight regardless of the expected outcome. And so we choose to do battle against the forces of darkness, fighting back against a malevolent movement that represents all that is bad in the world: fascism, authoritarianism, racism, misogyny, bigotry, a movement that uses anti-scientific disinformation as its preferred weapon. We do this not because our success is guaranteed. Given the forces mobilized against us, we are clearly the underdog, and no white wizard will come to our defense. But we have truth and justice on our side, and the stakes simply couldn't be greater. We fight for a livable planet, for us, our children, and future generations, because it's worth fighting for. Thank you.
That was Dr. Michael Mann at University of Pennsylvania graduation, May 16, 2025.
Radio EcoShock.
Now, on with James Hansen and acceleration. James Hansen has a new warning about escalating heat. Earth has become less reflective. We are sending less back into space, leaving more energy in the ocean, land, and air. Extrasolar energy expresses itself as more extreme heat, changed ocean currents, and potential for violent weather, and all of those are happening now. On May 13th, James Hansen and Pushkar Karicha published an article titled "Large Cloud Feedback Confirms High Climate Sensitivity." Don't let that quiet title fool you. As Hansen and Karicha say, this is a big effing deal, BFD. They say Earth's albedo has decreased by about 0.5% since the early 2000s. That sounds small, but it represents vast amounts of solar energy staying in the Earth system, energy greater than we can imagine. It translates to roughly half a watt per square meter extra, adding as much as half a degree to global average mean temperature. That is a BFD. Hansen's new paper suggests the extra energy is like adding 138 parts per million more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. NASA's Ceres satellite data and measures of Earthshine, that's reflected sunlight observed from the moon, those back up Hansen's 0.5% decline in planets' reflected energy. This is not a theory, then. But the cause is still debated by scientists. Michael Mann made respectful but pointed critiques of Hansen's recent papers, especially regarding claims of rapid acceleration in global warming, and the outsized role of aerosols. Mann argues that Hansen's conclusions overstate the case, that they're not well supported by evidence, and he says the truth is bad enough, without exaggeration. Hansen and his co-author conclude, Earth's darkening by itself provides strong proof that climate sensitivity is much higher than the IPCC's best estimate of 3 degrees C for doubled CO2, end quote. They think the doubling, likely before the year 2100, leads to about 4.5 degrees C of global mean warming. That is disaster. Here's a short clip released by James Hansen in February of this year, along with co-author Caricia, to accompany his related paper, Global Warming Has Accelerated, Are the United Nations and the Public Well Informed?
Hi, I'm Jim Hansen. Pushkar Caricia and I will discuss a new paper that explains the global temperature spike in the last 2 years. A tropical El Nino spurred it, but only explains part of the warming.
The other part is caused mostly by reduction of aerosols produced by ships. Aerosols are tiny particles that serve as cloud formation nuclei. They increase the extent and brightness of clouds, which reflect sunlight and cool the Earth's surface. When clouds are reduced, Earth becomes darker, thereby absorbing more sunlight, which causes warming. Ships are the main aerosol source in the North Pacific and North Atlantic. We use satellite measurements to estimate that ship aerosol reductions cause almost one-third of global darkening. Reduced snow and ice account for about one-tenth. So most darkening must be from cloud feedback, in other words, a reduction of clouds caused by global warming itself.
Large cloud feedback implies high climate sensitivity. Ocean temperature will not fall even as the tropics cool. Ocean hotspots and other extremes will grow. Warmer air fuels stronger storms, more extreme rainfall and floods, but also flash droughts and more extreme fires. We could adapt to those and minimize damage, but there's a bigger issue. The intergenerational effect caused by climate's delayed response. We find that present policies are likely to cause shutdown of the ocean conveyor circulation within 20 to 30 years, consistent with evidence presented recently by the Ditlevsons. Ocean conveyor shutdown would keep ocean heat in the southern hemisphere, speed up Antarctic ice melt, and raise sea level, eventually taking out coastal cities, Florida, Netherlands, Bangladesh, part of China. That's no reason for unhelpful alarm. Instead, we must clarify what is needed to produce a better future. Please read the epilogue in our paper. There's no technical science, just a message for young people and all people. Thank you.
The new May post from Hansen and Pushkar begins, Earth's albedo, or reflectivity, declined over the 25 years of precise satellite data, with the decline so large that this change must be mainly reduced reflection of sunlight by clouds. Essentially, Earth is more sensitive to greenhouse gases in the atmosphere than we knew, he says. The full effect of our emissions has been hidden by clouds and pollution, and that affects cloud formation. This is all part of the scramble by the top world scientists to answer a dangerous puzzle. Why was 2023 so much hotter, despite a weak El Nino condition? Why did Canada burn? Why were heat records set around the world? In April 2024, I asked Dr. Gavin Schmidt, director of the Global Institute for Space Studies at NASA, James Hansen's old job. Here is a short clip from that interview.
Radio EcoShock.
People in many parts of the world are suffering through extreme heat. The hottest year so far was 2023. The heat is still rolling in 2024 on land and sea. Scientists are scrambling to find out why. One of the top science journals in the world, Nature, just published this article, Climate Models Can't Explain 2023's Huge Heat Anomaly. We could be in uncharted territory. The author is the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, Gavin Schmidt. Since taking over from James Hansen in 2014, Schmidt continues research with peer-reviewed publications galore, and still makes time to communicate. James Hansen and Leon Simon say the spike was pushed by new regulations to cut ship emissions, leading to less cloud formation over that big Pacific shipping lane between Asia and North America. What do you think?
So we do know that there was a big cleanup in the shipping fuel that was being sold after that regulation. And so there is a decrease in emissions. The impact of that decrease in emissions on temperature is being studied as we speak. I saw a preprint of some of the results just yesterday, and lots of different modeling groups are looking at that. And it does seem to be having an effect. There does seem to be an effect there. But again, it's not huge when you look at the global mean. And so it doesn't really seem to match the temperature spikes that we saw. So it's an important candidate for what might have been going on. And maybe, you know, we need to refine that modeling, or we'll find bigger numbers. But right now, it doesn't look like that was the main driver either.
Why can't NASA measure the aerosol effect in real time?
That's an excellent question. So aerosols are very tricky to measure, and one of the things that we've been measuring is total aerosol optical depth. So that's the amount of stuff in the atmosphere, and we've had measurements of that for about 20 years. But the problem with that is that it doesn't distinguish between different kinds of aerosols, and different kinds of aerosols have different properties. So soot from biomass burning is absorbing, so that warms the climate. And sulfates from sulfur dioxide from shipping and from volcanoes and things is reflective. There are secondary organics, these are things that kind of add to the blue haze around forests and things. There's a lot of those things. There's mineral dust from deserts. There's sea salt that's been swept up from the ocean. And there's this big whole mix of stuff that's going on. And the impacts that has on the climate, it's very hard to tell just by knowing how much stuff there is in total. You really need to know what each individual component is doing. And until very recently, we did not have an instrument that was able to distinguish that. We have tried to do that. We had such an instrument on the Glory mission, but unfortunately, that was a successful takeoff, but it was not a successful orbital insertion, and it ended up in the South Pacific. And so that kind of set us back about a decade. We've just launched the PACE satellite, which everything seems to be checking out. We should be getting the first data from that, really in a matter of weeks. And that is going to tell us a lot more about what's happening to the aerosols and what their direct effects are. But there's still another piece of that puzzle, which is how those aerosols interact with clouds. Those are called indirect effects, and so it turns out that, you know, if you have lots more small particles, then you have a lot more small cloud droplets. That gives you a different kind of cloud than you would have had if you didn't have that. As clouds have a different lifetime, they dissipate more, they rain less. So there's all these indirect effects that give rise to things like ship tracks. So you can see these where the ships have gone by. You can often see a cloud, a contrail, if you like, behind the ship that has been created by these indirect effects. And that's still very tough science. These are all microphysical effects. It's very hard to study in a lab, and we don't have great in-situ observations. And so even when we will know how much aerosol of what kind is in the atmosphere, we will still have some uncertainty about how they interact with clouds, and therefore what impact the net impact they will have on climate. That's a real frontier of science.
You say this 2023 temperature spike, quote, came out of the blue. Maybe our past data is not a firm enough guide for something with the word change in it. Gavin, could we have misjudged the stability of nature?
I don't really know what that means. I mean, is it possible that there are surprises in the greenhouse and that we're going to see new things that we haven't seen in the instrumental record? Absolutely. You know, we are pushing the climate outside of the bounds of what we've observed, and we've been observing it well for the last 40, 50 years. We have reasonable observations going back 150 years. You know, we have different kinds of observations going back millennia or even millions of years. But we are We are embarked on, to quote Roger Revelle, a great geophysical experiment, which we will never be able to repeat and whose outcome is uncertain. That should be of great concern to everybody.
Related to the acceleration of warming, you should hear Professor David Victor. He delivers a stiff warning in the prestigious journal Nature. Global warming will happen faster than we think. His stellar co-authors are Yang-Yang Shu and V. Ramanathan, both previous EcoShock guests. Here is David Victor.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You may believe climate disruption is arriving sooner than we were told. You are right. Three powerhouse scientists have published a warning. Global warming will happen faster than we think. They explain three emerging threats that combine to bring climate danger out of that year 2100 and right into the next decade. Our guide to the comment, published by the prestigious journal Nature, is co-author David G. Victor. At the University of California, San Diego, Dr. Victor is a professor of international relations and director of the Laboratory on International Law and Regulation. He is a connected guy, often producing reports for the Brookings Institution, while publishing articles in magazines like The New Yorker. David Victor is the author of the book Global Warming Gridlock, published by Cambridge University Press. You know, about 10 years ago, I interviewed the famous climate blogger Joe Rome, and the accepted view then was that climate change would be slow and warming only 0.1 degree per decade. What is the new understanding of how fast Earth will heat up?
Well, the new understanding, which, again, we don't know exactly, but the new understanding is kind of double that rate in that ballpark. And the argument we made in our article was that it's accelerating. So it's not just that it's rising linearly at a rate faster than 0.1 degree, but that the rate itself is growing. And that's what's really concerning here, is you've got an exponential process with lots of uncertainty, risks that the climate system could really get out of control, and that the system is being torqued with these building emissions in the atmosphere, and that's causing exponential changes, not linear changes.
The second trend that you pinpoint in the comment is the partial success by government regulations to reduce air pollution. Surely less smog is good news for our lungs, but how is it also bad news?
Well, most of what you do to address other environmental problems also helps reduce climate change, but in a few areas, they work in opposite directions, and this is one of the areas. There are especially coal-fired power plants, but a variety of other sources, but especially coal-fired power plants emit a lot of pollutants. They emit carbon dioxide, which is what causes climate change. They emit nitrogen oxides, which cause acid rain and local air pollution effects. They emit sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain, and a variety of other pollutants. Sulfur dioxide is the one that we're talking a lot about in our article. And what happens to sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere is it turns into sulfate particles, which make clouds brighter. And so they actually ironically cool the planet a little bit. And the Chinese know that they've got a huge local air pollution and regional air pollution problem. So they've been investing very heavily in controlling emissions from their coal-fired power plants. They've shut down old inefficient plants, built new kinds of coal-fired power plants with all the latest pollution control equipment, and it's on and operating. And so they've very quickly lowered their emissions of these other pollutants, and that's been really good for Chinese health, and they need to do more, but it's ironically lessened this brightening effect, the mask, if you like, that's existed on climate warming, and that mask has had a large offsetting effect on climate warming. And so as that mask is removed more rapidly than this, almost all the scenarios had predicted, that's contributing to the accelerated warming.
How do scientists know there has been a reduction in air pollution? How do we measure such things?
Well, there's a variety of ways of measuring it. Some pollutants you can measure from satellites. There's a lot of, frankly, on-the-ground work by experts in power plants and other industrial technologies where they go off and look and see what kinds of technologies are installed and try and develop a story as to what is actually going on the ground. Some of these pollutants you can measure downwind, and so you have to put together lots of different data sources to get to this. You know, there's still a lot of uncertainty about Chinese energy statistics. There's still more uncertainty about Chinese CO2 emissions than you would like to have. And so nobody really knows exactly what's going on the ground, my guess is that even the Chinese government doesn't fully know. But the data picture has improved a lot, and it's all consistent with this story that the Chinese are aggressively trying to clean up their act. I mean, so much so that the air pollution, the kind of legendary air pollution problems in Beijing, although they still exist, they're now being eclipsed by legendary air pollution problems in other countries, and notably in India. I think India is going to be the next big story in this area, where there's going to be a need for cleanup and a need for more efficient and less polluting coal plants and alternatives to coal like solar. And that story, though, is still unfolding.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You should hear Professor David Victor. He delivers a stiff warning in the prestigious journal Nature. Global warming will happen faster than we think.
So do we know how much warming is hidden by global dimming or this layer of aerosols in the atmosphere?
Not exactly, but it's on the order of half a degree. And we have in the paper, we have some pointers to some other estimates, but it's something in that range.
So when the IPCC proposes to stay below 2 degrees C warming, and they use dubious carbon capture technology for those scenarios, do they include up to two-thirds of a degree more heating, which will emerge when air pollution is cleaned up?
Well, so there's a separate set of articles, that some of which I've been involved with, that have raised questions about whether we're in fact setting our goals for climate policy in the right way. And this is one of the key points of contention, that right now we talk about goals in terms of globally average temperature. In fact, globally average air temperature near the surface of the Earth. But the reality is that temperature is affected by lots of factors. Some of them are naturally variable in nature, including cycles in the oceans in the Pacific and the Atlantic, which might actually be one of the additional factors that's causing warming. So there's natural variability. And then most of the heat actually does not build up in the atmosphere. It builds up in the oceans. And so a number of us have raised questions about whether we should be looking at other ways of setting global goals that would be more directly related to how humans are affecting the climate and to the policies that humans are adopting to try and control their emissions. And that would make it easier to measure actual progress. Because right now, it's actually very hard to take the pulse of whether we're doing well or poorly with climate policy, because our major indicator is a globally average indicator that's responsive to so many different factors.
We have been talking with Dr. David G. Victor, Professor of International Relations and Director of the Laboratory on International Law and Regulation at UC San Diego. David is co-author of the paper, Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think. You can find links to follow up on all of this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Some of this discussion and Hansen's recent work was stimulated by observation from a non-scientist, Leon Simons, in the Netherlands. Let's hear it from Simons on Radio EcoShock, January 11th, 2023.
This is Radio EcoShock.
You may know James Hansen as a leading climate scientist from NASA, the man who warned Congress about global warming in 1988. Hansen is out with a new bombshell paper called Global Warming in the Pipeline. It is not yet peer-reviewed, but it's out there on the net for comment. The paper is huge. Hansen says we have already reached a doubling point of greenhouse gas emissions when we count the other global warming gases like methane, nitrous oxide, and a bunch of halogens. The authors also claim mainstream science has underestimated the power of what will happen now that the Earth is so far out of energy balance. This is disputed by other scientists. Finally, Hansen says, as he has for a decade, that when you add this up, sea level rise will be much higher than we have been told. We're going to start with just one of the most concrete and provable instances of hidden warming that is being revealed by a change in the atmosphere. This is the story of how clouds of pollution that cooled the sea and the land are disappearing, letting in the full power of the sun. Among the authors, we can find Leon Simons. Leon is not officially a climate scientist, and yet James Hansen credits Leon's contribution to this paper. Simons nailed a crucial change in ship emissions and cloud formation. Leon is an independent climate policy analyst and a Netherlands board member of the Club of Rome. From the Netherlands, Leon Simons, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you.
How could global shipping modify global heating?
Yeah, so there's two things to consider. Of course, there's the greenhouse gas emissions of global shipping. Many people will know about that. When the ships burn fuel, that's oil from refineries, which is more or less the end product. So the good stuff, let's say, goes to cars and to airplanes. And what's left is the more sticky stuff, which needs to be heated to be able to be burned in these chambers. It's more like in between oil and coal, let's say, so it's very thick. And that contains, of course, carbohydrates, and carbohydrates are contain the energy. And if these carbohydrates are burned, that releases CO2. So that's what most people will know about energy use, is the CO2 emissions associated with that energy use. But these fuels, which are taken from the ground, also contain sulfur. Most people know that if a volcano erupts, that a lot of sulfur is emitted into the atmosphere. If you are near a volcano, you will smell the sulfur. Fossil fuels taken from the ground contain sulfur, and the oil that is burned by ships had, until recently, a very high sulfur content. That was 3.5%. And sulfur, when it's burned, it will go into the atmosphere, and it will become very small particles. And these very small particles, they are very light, bright, and they will reflect sunlight. But these particles also act as what is called condensation nuclei, which means that water droplets in the atmosphere, water vapor, will condensate against this particle of sulfur, which makes it create clouds. But because these particles are very small, the sulfur particles are very small, very large and bright clouds will be formed. And when this is done over the oceans, the dark ocean will be covered by a large layer of clouds, which reflects sunlight. And with a lot of emissions over the oceans by about 50,000 ships over the past decades, that resulted in a cooling over the oceans. And with the reduction of sulfur fuel content, as litigated by the International Maritime Organization, the concentration of sulfur in the fuel reduced from 3.5% to 0.5%, and that results in a very significant reduction, of course, in emissions over the oceans, which is then resulting in a reduction of cloud formation, which reduces sunlight that is reflected back to space, and then accordingly there will be more heat absorbed by the ocean. And now from data from NASA, we can see that there's less sunlight reflected back to space, especially over regions of heavy shipping, which is, for example, between North America and Europe and North America and China. We see a very clear signal that there is less sunlight being reflected back to space, which is in line with the limited modeling studies that have been done, which predicted that especially in these regions there will be additional warming from reduction of sulfur emissions from shipping.
Did you establish the role of ship pollution relative to other sources of human-made aerosols?
Yes, there's indeed emission reductions from sulfur from in the United States, from cars, and but also especially with the reduction in coal use. When fracking started in the past decades, there was a significant switch to the burning of gas instead of coal, which reduced emissions of sulfur from the United States in about 12 years with 70%, and it was the same happened in China, as you mentioned, where a lot of coal plants either installed these scrubbers where they take sulfur from the emissions, or they close the dirty plants and build new ones which have these scrubbers. So indeed, there's a lot of policy happening globally which is reducing sulfur emissions. But we do see, especially in the regions where the ships sail, we see that especially there is a very significant increase in absorbed solar radiation. And that is a relatively pristine environment because there's, of course, there are no other industries and there's potentially some wind bringing pollution from other regions. But the atmospheric lifetime of these particles is about 10 days. Therefore, you expect the most effect over the oceans and the changes over the oceans coming from ships. Of course, we have still only about 2 years of data, starting in January 1st, 2020, when the most significant change in litigation was coming into effect. It's possible that it's variability or it's a different source, but the signal is really very strong. It's about 3.5 watts per square meter of increased solar radiation happening over the North Pacific, the North Atlantic, and the United States, this area combined, and a significant part of the globe. And especially by looking at such a large area, that helps to reduce the uncertainty of variability.
And one of the biggest concerns about geoengineering, like injection of sulfates into the upper atmosphere to cool the planet, is what if it stops for any reason, from economic breakdown to war or political change? Now, some people hear the term termination shock and they think of mass extinction. You led a 2021 paper about termination shock. What do you mean by that term?
Termination shock is a term that's often used when talking about geoengineering, where the climate is cooled down by especially putting sulfur into the stratosphere, and then that causes cooling. But if you stop, then the stopping that could result in rapid warming. But termination shock is also the effect of terminating other emissions. And the shock describes the rapid warming. The rapid warming is described as a minimum of about 0.2 degrees Celsius of warming in 10 years.
That is distributed globally, so it could be a lot more than that when it arrives on land, for example, in a heat wave or something like that.
Yeah, so this 0.2 degrees Celsius of warming in 10 years, that's a minimum to describe it as a termination shock. And we don't know if there will be a termination shock. That depends on the effect which it will have on the climate, which, again, are still uncertain, but the first signs is that it might be, the effect might be stronger than most even climate scientists thought. And indeed, the local, the regional effects will be stronger. So there will be more warming in areas where these emissions have been reduced, because that's also the areas where initially there was cooling. For example, in Europe in the 1980s, there was a very high amount of sulfur emissions from coal burning. And then for health reasons and to reduce acid rain, there were scrubbers installed at these coal-fired power plants. And then in the past decades, we've seen a very rapid increase in warming, and Europe warmed by about 2 degrees Celsius over the past 40 years. So since 1980 or 1990, Europe warmed by about 2 degrees Celsius, and that increase in the rate of warming was caused by reduced sulfur emissions, and which caused less clouds and more sunshine and more warming. If you want to reduce that effect by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, you would have to stop emitting any greenhouse gases for 10 years. If it results in temperatures which we have never seen ever in our lifetimes, we should know about that and we should be able to prepare for that. That there is an iceberg approaching, but we should be preparing, we should be getting the lifeboats ready, so to say.
Leon Simons is the independent climate analyst based in the Netherlands. He is co-author of the new paper, Global Warming and the Pipeline.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Did Leon Simons attribute too much to ship emissions as the cause of the excess warming since 2020? A number of leading scientists think larger natural systems are likely more important. But we hear about both in this sample from my interview with George Saloniotis. Satellites show more energy is staying on Earth instead of bouncing back into space. The sun did not change. So why were the last 2 years significantly hotter than any recorded before? For scientists, it became a race to find the cause. Now we have a confident answer based not on theories or models, but on raw observations. Blame the clouds. George Saloniotis is a research physical scientist at NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He came through physics to meteorology and entered the early days of climate science. Well, recently he crunched 40 years of satellite records with his team, and they were analyzing the cloud cover on Earth. They found the world's storm zones are contracting. The land and sea may be getting less shade, leading to record heating. This is breaking knowledge we need. From New York, George Seliotis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Does your research suggest changes in cloud cover warm the Earth more than human-made gases?
It's hard to say that it's more than greenhouse gases. Clouds are a feedback to the warming, meaning that greenhouse gases are a forcing. In other words, we emit more greenhouse gases and we force the atmosphere. Now, once the atmosphere is forced, it responds. And one of the responses is by making more or less clouds, or making more clouds of one kind and fewer clouds of another kind. So clouds are a response to the forcing. That's why we call them feedbacks. Now, how big or how strong is this cloud feedback is something that we haven't really confidently resolved yet. It may be that the cloud feedback in itself can be even bigger than the forcing at some points, but I cannot say at this point that we're confident that we know the value of the cloud feedback to the extent that we can judge whether it's larger or smaller than the forcing. Overall, it appears to be smaller than the forcing because clouds warm and cool the climate at the same time. They reflect sunlight and they cool the climate, but they also trap heat and they warm the climate. So when we add all the cloud effects together, it turns out that the feedback is relatively small, or at least our best estimate for the feedback. Again, we're not confident about this feedback number yet, so I cannot really give a definitive answer to that question.
Fair enough. Well, you obviously know former NASA scientist James Hansen. His team pointed to sulfur reductions in ship emissions as a probable cause of the recent spike in warming and the Earth energy imbalance. They found fewer clouds over shipping lanes in the Pacific. Is that enough to explain the extra energy? Are these the cloud changes that you covered in your two recent papers?
Well, the changes in shipping emissions is definitely one of the reasons for the recent increases in the amount of absorbed solar radiation at the Earth's surface. However, the changes in shipping emission regulations were imposed basically from 2020 on, so the effects are over the last 4 or 5 years, the effects that we're seeing from those new regulations. I mean, there were some regulations starting in 2015, but we believe that the main regulations really that had a real effect are the ones that started in 2020. The changes that I am showing in the last two papers, basically the last 40 years, so this reduction in the world's storm cloud zones is something that we observe in satellite observations of the last 40 years. So whatever is happening with the shipping emissions is in addition to this background of changes that is in response to the reduction of these storm cloud zones. So the two are not the same thing. One is a smaller, probably smaller effect, but much longer term, much more longer term. The other is a much more recent effect and may well be more intense overall.
You know, clouds and cloud study are super complex. There were several times when I just had to sort of walk away from your paper and then come back to it because it requires a lot of learning just to get there. But why don't we break it down a little bit? We could start with the zones of the atmosphere where your group found significant cloud change. Closest to the equator, what is this intertropical convergence zone in the atmosphere? What goes on there?
The intertropical convergence zone is a zone that basically circles the globe near the equator. It's a zone of very thick rainy clouds. It's a very wet with thick raining clouds. It's called a convergence zone because at the surface there's a convergence of the surface winds that favors the lifting of the moisture from the surface and therefore favors the formation of the very thick storm clouds in that region. So the intertropical convergence zone is this zone where the atmosphere is converging at the surface, is lifting up the moisture, and is producing very thick, very reflective, and very hard-raining clouds.
And you found some changes in the clouds in this intertropical convergence zone, or we could call it ITCZ. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, what we find when we look at the satellite observations is a narrowing of this intertropical convergence zone. Basically, this zone is becoming more narrow. Now, we're not the first ones to find this narrowing of the ITCZ. There have been studies in the past, in the last 10 years, that have looked at precipitation rather than clouds, because you can also see this intertropical convergence zone in precipitation observations, since that's a very hard-raining region. And they also found this narrowing of the intertropical convergence zone. Also, there have been modeling studies that find a similar narrowing of that zone with climate warming. So we have a reason to suspect that the narrowing of the zone is in response to climate warming.
From the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, we've been speaking with senior research scientist George Seliotis. And you can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Ships are not the only factor in human pollution, of course. Large parts of North India have been covered for months by dense smog. It's industrial. It's from cars. It has been unsafe to breathe outside in the Indian capital of Delhi sometimes. A couple of decades ago, Ram Ramanathan of the Scripps Institute documented this long-lasting cloud of pollution, calling it the Asian brown cloud. A similar bank of persistent smog formed over China during its rapid industrialization. Both China and India burn a lot of coal, which releases sulfates that reflect sunlight well. India in particular has been artificially cooled by pollution. Strange to think, isn't it? Naturally, billions of people call for better air. Both governments are working to reduce pollution. China has been more successful so far, and part of that is their choice for renewable energy. About a quarter of all cars sold in China are electric right now, and heavy diesel trucks are next for conversion. As both China and India clean up the air, there will be less sunlight reflected back into space and less cloud cover for shade. We will all heat up even more. Cleaning up deadly air pollution does not add to global warming. It reveals the true power of the warming gases we have already released. Our guest Yang Shu gave us a clear explanation of this double-edged sword on Radio EcoShock. The smog of rapid industrialization is thick, but Chinese authorities are working overtime to clear the air. But will air pollution get better or worse in a hotter world? Could cleaner air actually heat the planet? It's difficult to get the latest on the situation in China, but we have reached one of the best young scientists working on it. Dr. Yang Shu was educated in Beijing. He came to America to study with the legendary Ram Ramanathan at the Scripps Institution in San Diego. Now Yang is an assistant professor at Texas A&M University. He has already published 30 papers, with more in the works. Now, in a series of papers, you and your colleagues have investigated the behavior of air pollution in a warming world, and some of what you found is not what I expected. Could you describe those relationships between a hotter planet and the smog that we produce?
Yeah, there are two issues here, which is wrapped into the problem of the interaction of global warming and air pollution. By interaction, I mean air pollution can lead to less or more global warming. And the second half of this problem is global warming can also intensify or reduce air pollution. So let me explain the first part. We have all known the dominant cause of the global warming is from greenhouse gas emissions. But at the same time,
those chimneys producing greenhouse gas are also emitting air pollution, such as particles. And most of the particles are reflecting solar radiation back to the space and therefore cooling the planet. So those are exactly offsetting the global warming effect. But of course, overall, global greenhouse gas warming is larger. That's why we have observed long-term warming trend in the past century. But the problem is we could have experienced much more warming if we have not produced air pollution problem along the way, which means part of the global warming has been temporarily masked by air pollution from certain countries. But looking into the future, that trend will be well reversed due to the issues you have touched on, the health concerns, the visibility concerns in those regions, and the countries are taking fast actions to solve those issues. So if the air pollution problem will be quickly resolved in the next 20 or 30 years, that will contribute to a net warming instead of a cooling in the past. And that net warming will add on to any additional greenhouse gas warming. So that will bring us a much difficult problem to deal with in terms of adapting to climate change problem at a local scales. So that's the first part. I can explain more on the second part, but if you have question about the first half, I can further elaborate.
No, I think that we have talked about that on the program, how global dimming, as it were, can cool the planet, and we could be in trouble if we actually clean up all the air. We could go, I've heard figures from half a degree to 0.7 degrees warmer if the air was actually clean, and we'll talk more about that as we go along, but I am interested in the second part. For example, in January 2019, you co-authored a paper predicting worse pollution for East China due to increased greenhouse gases. So I'm left with the question, how can haze get worse even as the government tries to clean the air up?
Yes, let me explain on that. This is a trickier question, actually a very concerning one in my personal opinion, which is global warming can actually make air pollution issues worse by itself. So we all know the air pollution issue is coming from large emission, dirty emission, but also it's governed by meteorological conditions. Certain meteorological conditions can keep the particle emission longer in the atmosphere and make the concentration higher, which is affecting human health. But certain weather conditions, such as heavy rainfall or stronger wind, those can help remove the air pollution or dispersing air pollution to a different region, so help the local air pollution problem. What we have been studied using global climate model is the future global warming, mostly coming from greenhouse gas, will actually make the meteorological condition worse to remove air pollution from the atmosphere. This meteorological factor is working against local action to cut emission. I'm not saying the local emission is not working. I'm just saying the meteorological condition is doing the opposite to the emission cut, which actually means you need to cut more than you have planned to reach certain air quality goals than what you have expected, because global warming will not help you in this regard.
From Texas A&M University, we have been talking with Dr. Yang Yang Xu. He is the lead author in the new paper, Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think, as published in the journal Nature. He is an expert in the relationships between air pollution in China and climate change. Find links to the science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. I think Yang Yang has a powerful message. Cleaning up pollution is necessary. It can save millions of lives. But reducing air pollution during global warming means we need to do more to get less. It works, but not as fast as we might expect. I think this is true of the whole greenhouse gas overload. Already in serious impacts, from heat to destabilized weather and fires, we need to slash carbon emissions much faster. We will get less relief than if we'd done it 10 or 20 years ago.
The deeper we get into climate change, the harder it becomes to save what we can. But there is no other choice. Find links to all these interviews and supporting science in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for hanging in there and still caring about our world.